Not like the Edwin Newman show that I was on once. They asked me to go to an Edwin Newman show, and it turned out that a woman was going to ask me the questions, and then they were going to tape in his asking them so that he wouldn't have to interview me. And then it turned out, after she talked to me a lot about my theories about anti-Semitism, that she thought I'd written Gentleman's Agreement. And so I was interviewed by someone, not that I was supposed to be interviewed by, about a book I hadn't written.
That's unusual. And in fact, that used to be quite a practice that has been stopped by CBS. There used to be a broadcast here called Mike Wallace at Large.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike Wallace was always at large when the subject came in to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike Wallace never saw these people, right?
Yeah.
So they would always splice in Mike Wallace's question as if he mm-hmm. had been asking the question. So they got in trouble with that. That just was not the way we do it, or should do it. So the show is no longer on the air, but later they would write a line saying, a CBS news producer asked so-and-so such and such, you know, then that's the way they would do it. But a funny thing happened before we talk about you, and I have a lot of questions I want to ask you. I have a lot of catching up to do. I'm quite familiar with your stuff, and I have all your books, and so I decided I would bring in with me today, I would bring in A Summer Place, Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, what's the one on
Sense of Values?
Sense of Values, and of course the new one. So I put them in my case, and I said, well, maybe I better, you know, have you sign them, because I have them in my bookshelf. And I thought, well, as long as they're there, I'll bring them, have him sign them. Then I thought, well, no, I'll get, what shall we wear to this party, too? So I went back and I got that one. Then I saw Janus Island and Georgie
Winthrop,
and I'm doing this off the top of my head, a couple of others, and I throw those in the bag. So I did. I put them all in the bag, and I got all the way down the elevator, and I realized I had forgotten one book. So I went back upstairs to get that one. So I wound up bringing all the books that I had, which are almost, I think, almost everything that you had written, except maybe the last one, which is... I don't think I had the...
Pacific Interlude.
Yeah.
And probably the first one, Voyage to Somewhere, which is almost...
I guess I did... No, I never...
It's almost non-existent. Only 1,600 copies, I think, were printed, or 2,000 were printed. 2,000 were printed, 1,600 sold.
I have never seen a copy of that one.
Very few people have. It eventually came out in an East soft cover.
Mm-hmm.
And came and went. It was a nice little sort of memoir of the war in the Pacific.
I kind of lost track of you because in What Shall We Wear to This Party, you were writing about your life, and you were still in Ticonderoga.
That's right, yeah.
And you had just finished a bout with alcoholism.
Right.
You were trying to get your life back in shape. You'd had a book rejected for the first time in your life, and but you closed the book on a positive note.
Well, things went uphill after that, so
well,
I'm glad I did.
I want to catch up on what happened to you. Since I know about your life up to that point, just in a nutshell, tell me what happened to you after Fort Ticonderoga.
Well, that period in Ticonderoga was very difficult. I'm not excusing alcoholism. People drink because they're an alcoholic, not because of what happens to them. But it was also a tough period in that my mother died and Betty's father died, and we had other illnesses in the family. And it was a rough... People go through dark nights in their whole lifetime, and that was the darkest night. But after that, I wrote Small Town, which did fairly well. And then we moved to Putney, Vermont, because we thought that our youngest daughter, Jessie, might want to go to school there. And I wrote Ice Brothers, and that did really very well. And then Jessie didn't like Putney very much, so we went on to Long Island to try that, and I wrote The Greatest Crime there. And then Rollins asked me down to Florida, which is has always been a second home to me. And we went down there, and I wrote Pacific Interlude and this book.
Now, Rollins, you're talking about the college.
Rollins College, yeah, asked me to go down there just for a brief appointment. But we wound up staying not at the college, but in the town, Winter Park. And the writing went well, and personally, my health returned, and all has been fine.
You're living in Winter Park now?
Winter Park, Florida, yeah.
Are you teaching at Rollins currently?
No, I'm starting a big new book on Florida. I owe James Michener a debt because when I read Hawaii, I got the idea that I wanted to do a book on Florida on that scale. And I started doing research for that 3 years ago. I'm now deep in that. Professionally, the life has been fine, and personally, I've been very happy, and the children are all doing fine, and God's been very good to us.
Well, as I said, where did this party ended on an optimistic note. There was, as I recall, it's been some years since I've read the book, but there was an episode in the backyard of the house in which you were trying to affix a seat to a swing.
Oh, yeah, trying to get the rope over the limb. I still remember that as a kind of triumph because it was during that low period of our lives. And it was a low period because Mother came to stay with us during her last years and Betty's father came to stay with us in his last years, and it was like a hospital there for a couple of years, and both these people dying was very hard. Our youngest daughter, who at that time was about 10, wanted a swing, and there was this limb over very high, and of course a swing attached to a high limb is better than one to a low limb. You can swing much better on it. And I had this an old stove lid. I thought I could put a piece of clothesline on. I couldn't throw the big heavy swing rope, but I thought I could take this old stove lid and throw it like a discus with this clothesline on it. And I tried, and it was much too high, and I couldn't do it. And a lot of sort of people gathered around to sort of make fun of me while I was doing this impossible thing of throwing this stove lid over this limb, which was 30 or 40 feet high. It was really high. And I was knocking myself out, and I decided, you know, really, I couldn't do it. And people were sort of half laughing with me and half laughing at me for doing this. And all of a sudden, I reared back, and that lid just skimmed over that and came down and left the line over there. And I realized that I could, you know, build this thing. It just gave me a triumph at a time when I needed one. It was a tiny one, but I can still remember that stove lid sailing over that lid.
That was a wonderful moment in the book because after all these years, as a casual reader, I remember that.
Yeah, it's funny. One of those, sometimes the small triumphs stand out larger in your mind than the large ones.
I had read A Sense of Value many years ago, and I was, I think that you had stated somewhere in the book that it was autobiographical in nature, to a degree at least, but I didn't realize how autobiographical it was until I had read What Shall We Wear to This Party. I felt, as I was reading that book, I felt, haven't I read this someplace before? And I had.
Well, that's a danger. Repetition is a danger of autobiographical writing. That's one reason I'm getting off it. I've done 14 semi-autobiographical books. And there's a danger of repetition. Of course, I do these autobiographical books because I felt from the beginning that mine was the only life I really knew well. And the only excuse for doing autobiographical books is that we are like snowflakes, all individual and different, but all alike. And when people do come up to me, as they quite often do, or write to me that, how did you know my life? The answer is, I don't, but we are alike. And I am the snowflake under my own microscope. And I feel more honest writing about what's happened to me because I'm sure of it. But if I try to write about somebody else, even someone as close to me as my wife or children, their innermost thoughts, I cannot write about with confidence.
What about the alcoholism? Is that something completely in your past now?
Well, nobody who has been a drunk is ever free of the danger of it. Yeah, I have to watch it all the time. I'm not completely free of alcohol. I don't want to be completely, and in that way I'm unorthodox. Some physicians believe that patterns change as you grow older. I was never a drunk before I was about 45, and I started drinking too much then. I had drunk a lot, but I'd never been a drunk. But when I was 45, it hit me like a sledgehammer. And then when I got to be about 60, the pressures in my life let up a lot, and it is not as much a danger, but I am very aware of exactly how much I drink every day, and it can't be very much, or I just have to stop and regroup. It's a danger always to anyone who's ever, they say that once you are a pickle, you're never going to be a cucumber again.
So you have limits and you keep yourself down to X number of ounces or otherwise something?
I don't do it on a mathematical basis, but I know I start drinking too much. I know it because the craving sets in, and when that craving sets in, I stop. As long as I don't drink to the point where the craving starts, I'm all right.
Did you know that, did you see the Motion Picture Diner?
I did.
Wasn't that a wonderful scene where they walk out of the theater, which was showing A Summer Place, and they say, hey.
That's strange. You know, some of the actors in that I read in the newspapers are upset because they feel that they should have been paid for that appearance in Diner. And I don't know what's going to become of that.
That you should have been paid?
That all of us connected with A Summer Place. I own a quarter of the net of A Summer Place. And some of the other actors owe shares. And apparently, I don't know the legalities of this. I haven't gone into it yet. But apparently the idea that a large segment of this was shown in another movie upset some of the people involved. Personally, I was flattered by it and pleased, although it did make me feel a little bad to be part of a period piece, as though I were trotted out to show what it was like in 1800.
Tell me a little bit about The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit 2 and why you decided to write about Tom Rath and his family, I believe, 12 years later. Why didn't you just want to let The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit 1 rest and go on to other things? Why did you want to have a sequel?
Well, Tom Rath, the protagonist of that book, was only 34 when the book ended. And a lot of people asked, you know, what happened to him and what happened to his family. Did the happy ending of Gray Flannel 1, was that a temporary high, or did they really go on and live happily ever after? It was a semi-autobiographical book. A lot of publishers wanted me to do sequels to it, and I wanted to wait until I was old enough to see what actually happened to those people, and that turned out to be a long wait, 28 years. And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, if I do another autobiographical novel, it might as well be a sequel to it, because I'm writing about the same person that I based Tom Rath on anyway. And to put it in that framework interested me, and I was interested in divorce and remarriage. And seeing that I had already built the first marriage in that book, the end of that marriage and the start of a new one, it seemed logical to make that a sequel.
Still, what you have done is to create an image in the minds of your readers that, in effect, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit is your only book. And I know from lugging in a dozen books that that is not the case. So you are indelibly going to be connected with that no matter what you write.
Well, that doesn't bother me. You know, books are so ephemeral. They come out 1 month, and 3 months later, why, some of them are forgotten. In fact, most of them are forgotten a few months after they come out. I am grateful that one of my books has been remembered for 30 years. If that's the one that I'm going to be remembered because of, and I doubt whether that's true because I think that some of the things I've gotten involved in the future are going to be bigger, but if I am going to be remembered for this alone, all right, it's nice to be remembered for anything.
At least one of the critics was emphatic that Ice Brothers was your best book.
Well, in a literary sense, I think Ice Brothers is my best book, but the subject matter, World War II in the Arctic, is not one that grabs everybody. This Gray Flannel man, because he is a middle-class American, and almost nobody writes about the American middle class except people who slam it, from Sinclair Lewis to John Updike, they slam the middle class. Rabbit is a horrible creature, beautifully written about. And Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt was a horrible creature, written about with a pen used as a sledgehammer. I am a middle-class person, and most of America is middle-class, and the strength of any nation can be judged by the size of its middle class. If it doesn't have a large middle class, it's a weak nation. The United States has an enormous middle class, which is fundamentally why it's a very strong nation. I don't understand why people have such scorn for the middle class. If you just judged America by contemporary novels, you'd think that we were a nation of murderers, Russian spies, and that's about it. And perfectly terrible people like Rabbit, who run from every responsibility. I like to think of Tom Rath is the opposite of Rabbit, in another way, the opposite of Jack Kerouac's figures who ran off on the road. Tom Rath, the man in the great final suit, for whatever his weaknesses, handles his responsibilities. That's why I think it's important to the part about the illegitimate child in the war that he left behind in Italy. In the war, American troops, of course, left hundreds of thousands of illegitimate children in every country that they visited during the war. Not that we're different than any other army. Every army leaves these pathetic waifs. The American army, I believe, left more waifs than dead bodies of the enemy. And you could take that as a triumph of the life force, that we sent millions of people overseas to kill people, and they ended by causing more births than deaths. But it's not much of a triumph of the life force to leave starving children. Pearl Buck and many other people have been emotionally involved in the spectacle of these hundreds of thousands of children. It was meaningful to me to bring this into this book because I am talking about a man who lives up to his responsibilities. He does not run. And when he learns that he has an illegitimate child, that he left one abroad, he sends him money.
So, Wilson, do you still have the boat?
No, I sold the boat. We live in central Florida now, 45 miles from the ocean. And also, I've sort of outgrown boats. Boats had some deep meaning to me when I was a young man. I thought I was more of a man on a boat than I was ashore. It was pretty hard to be a man ashore, but on a boat it was pretty easy. A lot of people thought it was harder to be a man on the boat. But when I was a boy, the women ran everything ashore. My family is made up of very strong women, and I like strong women. My wife is a strong woman. But on the boat, the man is sort of in charge of it. I think I was impressed by that at an early age. And as in Ice Brothers is really a rite of passage book about how a boy becomes a man. And because I, in a sense, became a man after being hammered by North Atlantic gales at the beginning part of World War II, it gave me a certain kind of self-respect to be on a boat where I knew the ropes, literally, and often ashore I did not know the ropes. So that I needed a place where I was an expert. And because I have been around boats since the age of about 8, I am an expert on small ships. So I needed this place where I knew what to do, but now I'm learning what to do ashore a little better, and I don't need the boats anymore.
You've been writing for most of your life now. Tell me about how you organize yourself as a writer and how you approach it.
I sold my first piece 40 years ago, which is a poem to the New Yorker when I was 24 years old.
A poem?
Poem to the New Yorker. The soldiers who sit. I would like to write a poem about the soldiers in this war who just sit. They sit 365 days a year. To understand that, you would have to write day, 365 times. Went on like that for 56 lines. And I sent that to the New Yorker, and then I followed it with another poem called Cup and Lip, which was written just before the war ended, which was... At first I was quite brave in war. Fear of defeat kills fear, but death is difficult to face when victory grows dear. And a lot of men were killed in the last day of the war, and I got letters from their parents over that poem, Cup and Lip. The poem broke my own heart. But I gave up writing poetry because I realized that I'm an old-fashioned poet. You can understand what I write. And I was out of style. I couldn't understand most of the poets that W.H. Auden and the others that were being much lauded. I couldn't really understand them. And I was feeling my way toward my best skills. And I realized I'm a storyteller. That's what I am. Even when I was a boy at school and was not much good at athletics and not much of a scholar, one of the teachers who remembers me at Exeter Academy, which I hated because it was cold and I had to study Latin and algebra all the time and play games I hated like football, said that what he remembered about me was gathering rings around me while I told stories. I love to tell stories. But I'm a storyteller, and storytellers should write novels, not poems, or short stories, which is what I started with. How I organize myself, I don't. I have no, I'm the least organized person in the world. I get up in the morning, usually very early, with an urge to get to my typewriter, or now word processor, with the story building in me where I had left it off, and it just comes rushing out, and it is not organized, and as a result often has to be rewritten many times. I am a man who does not have the whole book develop in his head before he starts. I have to try to write it, see what's wrong with it, and do it over again, sometimes many times. It's not organized any more than, it's an act of passion more than of the intellect.
One of your fellow Floridians, Dick Francis, lives in Fort Lauderdale, was telling me, as a matter of fact, I was working on the piece today, that he never lets his writing stand in the way of things he really wants to do, which is go to Hialeah. So he's perfectly willing to drop his writing and go off to the races. So he also is, although he starts writing early in the morning, so, and the races don't start that early, but generally he, too, is kind of a disorganized person. And, but many other writers I've talked to like to approach their work as though they were working in an office, and there's an eight-hour day there, and they start at 9 o'clock, and they finish at 5, with time out for lunch.
Well, chacun a son goût, each to his own taste, but there are very few things, frankly, in the world that I like to do. I love to write, and that's really why I've been in this business for 40 years, with its ups and downs and its impossible economic situation. I simply love to write. I am a very tense person. I wake up, I don't know what to do with myself, walk around. I can't drink to get rid of the tenseness, because that'll kill me. I can write. And when I start to write, the hours go by. I start to write sometimes at 4 in the morning, and I look up, and it's still 4, but it's 4 in the afternoon. And I got 30 pages on that word processor, and I feel marvelous, because some of them are good. And I don't want to go fishing. I don't want to go to the racetrack. I want to be with my wife. I want to see my daughter. I want to just lie down afterward and have the one drink that I permit myself, or a bottle of beer. I want to go to sleep and get up and write again the next day, and the excitement of seeing a good book build, knowing that it is doing some of the things that I saying some of the things that I very much want to say, things that I passionately feel and have no other podium for. It, to me, is the most thrilling thing in the world. It's exciting to me. It's not boring. It's exciting.
You published your first piece 40 years ago, which makes you a senior member of the Academy. Morris West was telling me that he is also a senior member of the Writing Academy, and he has found that as he becomes older, writing becomes more difficult because there's a sense of deja vu. The techniques and style is easier, are easier for Morris West, but he's always afraid of repeating himself.
Well, that's why I had to get off of semi-autobiographical novels and into historical fiction, because I had reached that, and I realized I need a new genre. I can take, as I just have, one of the Spanish conquistadors, Pedro Mondanez, and read everything I can about him and try to crawl into his skin and realize what it was like in 1560 to come over here from Spain. And I get lost in that world, and there's nothing deja vu in that world for me. By the way, Morris West is a writer that I admire very much, and a man I admire very much. He and I went off and had a wonderful night of hopping saloons and talking. I wish I remember more of it. He said some marvelous things, but I don't remember him very much.
Did you know he was a Christian brother?
I know that entirely. Once he said to me, this I remember, he said to me, you know, we writers and probably everyone, he said, we worry that we're going to go broke. And he said, we worry that the public's not going to love us anymore. We worry that we're going to lose our health. He said, it's all going to happen. He said, no writer stays rich long. Government gets him if nobody else does. And the public isn't going to love you for long. They got other things to love. And we're not going to be healthy. We're going to die. And he said, when you realize that and can still be happy and work, you're a man. I've always loved him for saying that.
Are you doing the research for your Florida book yourself?
I've hired a top assistant this for this summer. She's my daughter, my youngest daughter, who's just finishing her sophomore year at the University of Rochester in New York. And she's going to be my leg girl.
Well, you know that Michener practically has a staff of people doing all this work.
Well, I've heard contradictory things about that, but I've discovered something. I can pay nobody to read for me. I have to get this information in my head. Details can be given to me, but I have to really get into these characters, and there's no way anybody can help me much. Now, with Jessie, my daughter, I'm just coming up. I've done the part on the Conquistadors, and I've done the part on the Seminoles, which is fascinating to me. Now I'm coming up to Henry Morrison Flagler, who, beginning in 1873, changed Florida from a wilderness to the nation's winter resort in a period of about 28 years. He waved his golden wand and changed Florida from virtually an untouched wilderness. He built hotels which housed 40,000 people, plus the railroad, the first railroad that brought civilization to Florida. Now, he was a fantastic character. He built these castle-like hotels in the wilderness. I want to reincarnate one of those hotels, the ghosts of the people who were there. I want to reincarnate them on people. Now, to do that, he was recent enough so that more than books and libraries can be studied. I want Jesse to go down and look at the old newspapers, police records, hotel registers, and give me as many hints as you can about what those hotels were really like.
Well, you better hurry. Michener's in Texas this week. I understand he may be in Florida 2 weeks from now.
That's fine. There's nothing like having the highest competition, but nobody's going to do this book the way I'm doing it. In the first place, I was brought up in Florida, and he wasn't. And Betty and I lived aboard an old yacht and floated around Florida for 7 years between 1966 and 1973. And then when we moved down to Florida 4 years ago, I got a swamp boat and explored all those swamps for a couple of years. Michener can follow me in that research, fine.
I think Florida is your territory, all right. Well, Sloan Wilson, I know I'm probably going to run out of tape in a moment, but I did want to say that you have certainly entertained Americans for many, many years, and myself one of them, and I think we all should thank you for that, because you've given all of us a great deal of pleasure through your writing.
I'm grateful for being supported while I did it.
I'm very grateful. That's right. Well, we helped to subsidize you as well. And I hope that when you finish the book on Florida, is it going to be Arbor House?
We don't know yet what the publisher is going to be.
Well, I hope that no matter who publishes it, we'll have you back in New York and we'll talk about
Florida. Well, thank you. I look forward to it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.